Today's show brought to you in part by our friends at Santa Anita. Huge weekend for contest players out there. 4-day weekend, 4 contests. And that's making the weekend start on Friday, which I think for many of us, it does for Memorial Day. $80 express bet only feeder on Friday to win seats into the next day's Santa Anita Challenge. That is a $500 contest where you can win cash and seats into the big contest on Monday, May 30th, the $1,500 Gold Cup Challenge. Another opportunity on Sunday, May 29th, to win in to the Big Monday contest with a $150 Gold Cup Challenge feeder, also express bet only on that one. Once again, seats to Monday and cash. Then Monday, the big one. $1,500 is the buy-in. There's going to be NHC seats. There's going to be Pegasus seats. There's going to be cash. It's a huge weekend for contest players. You can play on ExpressBet. You can play the two bigger events out at Santa Anita itself. To get more information about this, very simple. You see the website up there now on your screen. It is santaanita.com, and then just go under their handicapping contest tab, and you'll see the four events right there. Get involved. Go there to get more details. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players podcast. This is our show for Monday, May 23rd. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn bunker once again, and happy to be joined by a man coming to you from the planet Texas, not the usual man we have in here from the planet Texas. So I don't know about that word usual. He's been on more than anybody lately, especially doing, you know, triple duty on the late week shows. I'm speaking of from InTheMoneyPodcast.com, Nick Tamaro. Nick, how are things?
Doing great, Pete. How are you?
Life is good. Life is good. Tired, man. Slept a lot last night and feel like I could, you know, sleep another day. The Triple Crown weeks when you work, obviously doing the stuff that we do, gets a little crazy. But I don't know why I'm telling you this. You do basically everything I do and then go call the races at night. So I would imagine you need a little bit of R&R too.
I could use a respite probably, but I did take those couple of days off early last week. So I'm a little fresher, but no, feeling good and ready to, we've got an exciting few weeks coming up for us on the network with Lone Star's big day next week. We have our Memorial Day Stakes extravaganza for the New York Breds. And that leads us, of course, into Betmakers Day at the races on June 4th, our friends over there in the Belmont. So a little promo on our recap show.
I love it when somebody else does that heavy lifting, so I don't have to be the only one taking care of our people. But you're right. If you're not already planning on playing the horses on Monday, you got to, because, yeah, we have those two partnered events. And then not a partnered event, but maybe something we almost have to do something on Plus, I'm guessing, if Maryland are going to pay out their mandatory with all the extra money they get off the you know, off the handle this weekend. So we'll see. We'll see. We may have even some bonus coverage. Monday going to be a very busy day if you're a horse racing fan. Make sure to block it out. And, of course, yes, our main interest with Lone Star and our friends at NYRA/NYTHA, who are sponsoring that broadcast that day. But you mentioned the Belmont Stakes. Let's go back to last Saturday and talk about the Preakness Stakes won by early voting. You know, this was an instance we've said on the show very recently, as a couple of weeks ago, you want to make God laugh, make a plan. Well, this is the opposite example, where connections of early voting not only concocted a plan that they pulled out to perfection, but right down to the ride and what Jose Ortiz was able to accomplish during the running of the race. He earned a 105 buyer speed figure in victory, a figure that I think looks pretty legit, though you're the expert on that. I'll throw it to you. But all in all, let's start with the winner. What'd you think of early voting?
Yeah, as far as the figure goes, this looked like a very straightforward day of figure making. It was a variant that I don't think was split. It looks like it was consistent throughout the day. So seems like a very reliable figure. You know, I think people have to remember and understand that these horses are getting better. They're going to get faster as time goes by. And, you know, hats off to the connections who obviously hatched a plan and it worked to perfection. You very rarely have the luxury, I'm sure, as a trainer to have an owner that's willing to say, sure, I'll skip the Derby because I don't think it's in the best interest of my horse to then run in the Preakness. And fortunately, you know, the Preakness means something to Seth Klarman, and the Preakness means something to the racing world. So it's nice that it was viewed as such by one of racing's most prominent owners, if not racing's biggest individual owner. And so, you know, the story, the feel good story about him growing up close by and it being his birthday and all of those things really made it work. But it's one of those where afterwards, you know who the smartest guys in the room were, because let's be honest, early voting would have finished somewhere around 13th in the Derby. And so they made exactly the right decision. They put him in position to win a classic. He is now in the conversation for the Eclipse Award. He is now a stallion. You know, there are a variety of things that happened on Saturday for him, and they're all good.
Not a bad birthday present, getting to stand in the winner's circle there, Pimlico, with the Woodlawn Vase nearby. When you talk about him finishing 13th, obviously the pace was the main reason why I think we can agree that the Derby wasn't going to be the race for him. But even the way it played out on track, with him opening up there briefly, and then to my eye anyway, Nick, appearing to tire a bit, wandering, suggested that, as they suspected, that extra 15th of a mile may have been a little bit of an issue for him.
Yeah, it could have been. You know, I think there's probably two interpretations of that final 70 yards or so, one of which is that Epicenter was coming at him. There's no doubt about it. He was getting there, and nobody else was really moving at that point in time. I think that it's probably 40% early voting tiring and 60% gamesmanship / race riding by Jose Ortiz. He figured if Epicenter is going to pass me, he's not going to do it on the rail. And that's okay. I think that's a good thing. That's a healthy thing to exist. There was another move by Jose Ortiz in this race. There are actually a couple of them. He looked for Epicenter twice. And I think he was a little surprised both times. But you'll notice, as Armagnac is about to clear in front of him in the first probably 3/16 of a mile, he looks over his right shoulder to see where Epicenter is. And then halfway down the backstretch, he looks underneath his legs to see if he sees Epicenter then. And so it might not have only been Steve Asmussen that was surprised by where Epicenter was in the first 3/4 of a mile of the race. I think Jose Ortiz was too. And so I thought those were both kind of interesting. It has to be said, it was a completely flawless ride on his part. He was unflappable. It was pretty much vintage Jose Ortiz. He's at his best when he's forwardly placed. He's a finesse rider more so than a power finisher or anything like that. I think he went in with a plan and he executed it perfectly.
It's very well put, and you bring up a lot of good things there. We'll, of course, have to talk about the ride on Epicenter. I did a little written piece where, you know, during the race, I was screaming at Rosario. Of course, then we have the ability to watch the tape, and you can see that there can be more than one thing at play. I mean, I just felt like he was not, you know, well, clearly he wasn't in the position where you want it to be. Being far off the pace on that day. Now, granted, we did see some horses make closing runs, but I think it's safe to say that the track was, we'll put it mildly and just say it was kind to speed. And then, of course, with the expected race flow, the idea that if you told me before the race Epicenter would have been eighth, I would have thought he would have had to get, like, truly body slammed or something more disastrous than what happened out of the gate. Now, as it happened, the horse didn't really break. And, you know, I mean, if it was debate class and I wanted to make a case, I could say, well, once he had to check early, you know, he just decided rather than rush up, I'm going to try to find a spot and make a closing run. The horse has shown that he has finish, and it certainly wasn't a bad day to be on the rail, though to my eye, I thought it was more of a speed track than it was a rail track. At the end of the day, I'm just going to sort of throw up my hands and say, I'm not going to be as harsh as I was in the immediate aftermath. I'm just going to say it was a little bit questionable and certainly not the way they wanted it to work out. I think we can all agree on that. What did you think about the ride? Was it a blunder by Rosario, or was it more circumstance?
A lot of times what happens in situations where rides end up being bad is that one bad thing happens and it becomes multiple bad things. And I think it's a little bit of that, but I really don't think the ride was bad. I think everybody should really watch those first 10 strides out of the gate. And what you'll realize is that this horse didn't have the speed that he customarily had prior to the Derby. And that was hugely detrimental because it put him way behind the eight ball when they were trying to get position early. So shortly after leaving the gate, which he left a half a step slow. My belief is that when a horse does that, they're generally going to get into declining form pretty soon.
Yep.
Good horses in good form break quickly. Good horses very rarely break poorly in this country. So it can happen in Europe. It obviously does. But because on dirt, you can't be at a decided disadvantage every single time and trying to make up ground. So he breaks a half a step slow. They come out of the gate, and Rosario is immediately asking him to go. But between Skippy Longstocking kind of being on his shoulder and not really having that same early zip, he loses his position. And when he lost his position, it became exponentially worse, because now Skippy Longstocking kind of cleared him a little bit and pushed him in a little bit to Secret Oath, and he clipped heels a tad and had to steady back. And now you're looking at a situation where he's in eighth, and this is a horse that we were expecting to probably be third, you know, at worst, a length and a half or two off the lead. So I think from there, Rosario did all he could to get him into a position where he still had a shot to win. And I think he ran very well, all things considered. I don't think it was a disadvantage to be inside. I think that was, you know, it was a good, if you're going to be that far back, you might as well save ground. And so I think as far as what happened start to finish, I think Joel did everything he possibly could. I see, you know, all of the experts on social media saying, oh, he'll have a different rider next time and this and that. And I know his Epicenter's trainer has been known to bench a rider or two over the years.
Itchy trigger finger maybe in that regard.
Yeah, but, you know, the one question, just to, I guess, to be hypothetical about it, Pete, is first of all, who exactly are you putting on that's better, right? Two guys come to mind is it. And they're both going to be represented with horses as the end of the year comes about, or are Pratt and Irad. And obviously Jose Ortiz has a mount now. So are you, and those guys are not regular riders for Steve Asmussen. The irony of irony, I guess, would be Ricardo Santana getting back on the source. Yes. But I don't think that'll happen. I think, and Rosario's also ridden a ton of horses for Steve Asmussen in the last 7 months and ridden them very well. I mean, he had two stakes wins on Saturday anyway. So I think he's getting a lot more blame than he should. And perhaps I'm giving Jose Ortiz a bit more credit than I should, because riding a speed horse often is kind of a turnkey operation. But I don't think it was as perplexing and as disappointing as it might have been in the initial reaction from the race.
You bring up some really key points, and I think the most interesting one, and the one that people could really take something from that's going to help them cash tickets in the future, is that idea of horses who start to break poorly as an indication of overall declining form. I think Arrogate, for me, is the poster child for this. You know, in his post Dubai World Cup efforts, it just felt like, you know, he lost that alacrity and he still had
so dull. Much talent. Yeah,
exactly. And here's the thing. I mean, I'm tempted to say in the reading of the race that the horse wasn't more forward because Rosario grabbed too quickly. And I really want to watch the first 10 strides again, because I did think there was a moment where he could have been aggressive. Watch it again while we're talking, Nick, and tell me if I mean, I'm absolutely copying the fact that I could be wrong about this. But I did think there was a moment where he chose to grab very, very early, like pre-check, that proved decisive. And that's part of why, and, you know, also just the visceral reaction of watching a race. Most of the time, I feel like in my analysis of horse racing, other than numbers that tell a different story, it's a case of first thought, best thought. So I'm hesitant to like get off my opinion that there was some error there. And if you want to bring rider error into play, I think you can say, you can make a pretty cogent case that Epicenter was best in two Triple Crown races without winning one. But at the same time, that ability to get away from the gate, if it's the horse's fault, you know, that's a skill. Getting away from the gate is a skill for both horse and rider. And if he didn't get out of there because he was, you know, in its subtlest possible way going off form, then I think it's probably not right to say that he was best and he just ran a really good race and was second best. And I'll say this, the fact that he's already been ruled out of the Belmont Stakes, I mean, that does nothing to dissuade me of the idea that it is more of the declining form situation than the rider error situation. God, I'm going to get splinters in my ass, Nick, from sitting on the fence so much lately on the show between this issue and the extension of the Triple Crown series, which we'll get to in a minute. But looking at that replay again, is there anything to what I'm saying? Or, I mean, is it Rosario's trying to get him to go forward and he's just not?
Rosario tried to get him to go forward and he didn't. The thing is, it was not a prolonged attempt, if that makes sense. It was, he didn't have a lot of time to do it because he broke a half a step slow. And so, you know, there are the one of the things to remember when you're watching a race and you're trying to analyze trips and being critical about it is there are a lot of different ways to break slow. Did you break slow because somebody came over on you at the start? Did you break slow because you simply didn't get out of the gate? You know, did you break slow because you stumbled? There's a lot of different things that can go on. And one of the biggest mistakes you can make is assuming that a horse had some kind of trouble because they broke slowly. There are also situations where breaking slowly can be an advantage. They are definitely in the minority of the time.
In a meltdown, happens, though.
But, right, exactly. I mean, late running horse in a ultimately in a collapsed race, breaking slow is fine. So this was a situation where he broke a half a step slow and Rosario tried to get him into a place that would have given him an outside stalking trip. He couldn't hold his position and he lost it at that point. And I think the biggest issue that you run into is that he ultimately has not had as much speed in his last two races. And that has been hugely detrimental. Now, it was huge. I should say it was hugely detrimental on Saturday. It really wasn't in the Derby. The fact that he was taken back in the Derby was an advantage. So I think it's going to be key for us to really look going forward if when Epicenter comes back, if he is a fast horse early, because, you know, he made his money this spring as a speed horse. And that's really the going to be the key. So if he's able to do that, then he'll become much better. The other thing that you remember about these particular connections is that, you know, they had an incredible 2017 with Gunrunner, and it had everything to do with him becoming a speed horse again.
Yep.
And they stopped rating. They stopped relaxing. They just put him on the lead, and he ultimately blossomed incredibly.
It'll be very interesting to see. Unfortunately, we're not going to see it in the Belmont Stakes. We're going to get to the Belmont and the Triple Crown question before we get out of here. But let's run down through the field and see if there's any other observations that either of us want to share about some of these other runners. I do think that Creative Minister's big run did point to the idea that Sean Borman had espoused on the Pro Player show that the previous figure was a little bit low. I feel like he franked the idea that that allowance race was a little bit faster, ran a big race, and looks to me like a key player potentially when you look at his pedigree heading into the Belmont Stakes in 3 weeks' time. What do you think about Creative Minister and his chances going forward?
Yeah, I think he has kind of a last man standing type of chance. You know, he's not really getting better at the rate that they're all getting worse, which is probably me being a little unfair. But he did run a fast race by his standards. I think he got 100 buyer. And so I think he now becomes a prime contender for the Belmont. I imagine, gosh, off the top of my head, based on who's slated to go, I could only really see Mo Donegal, Rich Strike, and as crazy as it sounds to say that, and maybe one other horse taking more money than him.
Yeah, he should be very much in the betting market at the top there, just because of the way we know the way those triple digit figure horses tend to attract wagering attention. And we see that it's wonderful in a way, being a horse player. It's wonderful. I don't think too many people had the wrong idea when it came to the betting in this race, Nick. And by that, I mean a lot by that. I mean, obviously, the betting was patently insane with horses that were 50 to 1, should have been 50 to 1, 100 to 1, being 11 to 1 and 13 to 1. So the wrong idea in that sense, which I think was just the predictable knock-on effect of having an 80 to 1. People say, oh, an 80 to 1 ran 2 weeks ago, let's bet the long shot here. I think that's just human nature. And we don't get to see this on a Thursday at Belmont when so much of the money is sharp. And it's sort of a wonderful hearkening back to the old days when, you know, there's stories about at Belmont, you couldn't bet a horse with Irish in the name because they'd all be half the price that they should have been. You had dumb public money creating inefficiencies in the betting pools is something that we should all be applauding. It seemed like people on Twitter were somehow offended by it though, Nick, which I thought was funny. You know, don't knock on the tank when the fish are let the fish do their thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, in this overwhelming haste to assume that everything is corrupt or you know that everybody is incompetent or things like that. I mean, I saw tweets like this needs to be investigated. What is going on? You know what's going on? The same people who bet every day are betting the Preakness, right? But we're joined by a ton of people who don't bet every day. And so those people were all betting so that they didn't miss out on the long shot. You know, I stood in the grandstand at Belmont staring at the tote board in 2003. I was young once. and couldn't believe with minutes to post for the Belmont that supervisor had $1 million bet on him to win. He was the longest shot on the board in that Belmont. That was a 6-horse field that was obviously headlined by Funny Side, Empire Maker, and 10 Most Wanted. And I thought to myself, who the hell would bet on this horse? And he went off 25-1, and I believe he finished last, similar to the way that Happy Jack and Fenwick both ran. And, you know, I mean, it's purely anecdotal because it's my own experience, but I sat in the jockey club at Sam Houston after we finished our card and watched the race, and two different people said to me, well, I bet on Happy Jack because my grandson's named Jack, or my brother's name is Jack. And so, and Jack Jenkins texted me and said, a friend of mine texted me and said, he wants 50 across on Happy Jack. I think I'm going to book it. I said, I think you should book it. So, you know, I mean, these things happen. There is recreational money involved in these pools. You know, my mother bet on Happy Jack in the Derby, and I told her that she had a max bet of $2. So, you know, this stuff happens. Not everything is some great conspiracy or some situation where something untoward is going on. And, you know, I told Pat Cummings Saturday night, I said, see what you've done? You've created everybody thinks that everything is messed up.
There are plenty of things that we can concoct conspiracy theories about. However, the betting in the Preak is not one of them. Got to go with the Occam's razor solution. And I think you nailed it. Everybody knows somebody named Jack. And as far as just, you know, Fenwick was the 50-1 on the morning line. So people are, you know, people don't understand what, you know, how parimutuel betting works.
Which was an accurate morning line.
Exactly. It was a very good morning line.
In the picks, he was what, like 80-1 were his imputed odds in the pick five, I think?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the more amazing differences in imputed odds from the double, you know, that Marshall Graham is famous for posting out there on Twitter. He'll appreciate my saying that. It's just incredible, the differences in prices. Now, the idea of this for the uninitiated is that double, normally in a parimutuel market, the bigger pool is going to be sharper, I would think, but not so on these Triple Crown days. And the idea that anybody who's betting a bet that connects the winner of the Black Eyed Susan to the Preakness is going to have some clue of what they're doing, as opposed to the pure recreational money that we see. And so it's very interesting to examine the differences. You can do that. Follow Marshall Graham at Truxton Stables on Twitter, and you'll get a chance to see the numbers I'm talking about. But yeah, the Occam's razor solution, you absolutely nailed it. It's just silly public money. We should be happy about it. We should be thinking, how can we get these people to bet more than three times a year is what we should be thinking. And that's a question we will get to, I promise. But we should talk about the filly, who I feel like Speed Figures as a tool really came across very well in this race, in the sense that I think she ran her race, and as many of us suspected, it wasn't good enough to trouble the best of these. But boy, she had a tricky trip too, and is really, really good, and I think is going to be a big player in her division going forward. Is she even better than that? I mean, I can't imagine they're going to try the boys again, but I feel like it's not. I'm sort of speaking out of both sides of my mouth again, saying she had a trip and that yet that figure represents her ability. I suppose I'd upgrade it 2 or 3 points for the trouble early and for being against the race flow. But at the same time, I mean, it feels like she should just go and be the best 3-year-old filly at this point.
Yeah, I think they've done their part in seeing whether she can be competitive with colts. And at this point, she's probably just a cut below. And it would take an extreme situation for her to win a grade one. Where there are colts in the race, but I don't blame them for trying. And yeah, I think Wayne Lucas kind of laid out a plan that starts with the Coaching Club American Oaks at Saratoga, and then I'm sure includes the Alabama. And I think against Philly, she probably has a bit of an edge at 1.25 miles. So I think they lost absolutely nothing in defeat. And I think she's a filly who will be very tough if she continues to move forward. You know, one of the things that they probably need to sort of get to with her as well is that she seems to have lost a little bit of her speed, and she needs to get a little bit more forward position back. She was a horse who was most effective when she was just a little bit off the pace. And I don't really think there was any early trouble that kept her from getting a more forward position. I think it just had more to do with she wasn't asked for much speed early, and she kind of, you know, kind of lost position, which of course, as we said earlier, that's what happens on dirt. She did, I guess she got in a little traffic, but she was going to the back of the pack anyway.
Yeah, she wasn't going to show a lot more speed, but I do think she lost a little bit of position. I think, did somebody come over on her, if I'm remembering it right?
Yeah, in the first furlong or so. It was a, for a small field, it was a little bit of a rodeo. And I'll tell you what, you know, what probably made that happen was Johnny Velasquez came out on simplification, not in a, you know, in an aggressive type of way, but he wanted to get right off the one path. And the fact that basically the 2, 3, and 4 showed no speed at all, you know, it just made for a packed up bunch in that first furlong. I mean, Fenwick was asked for no speed. It was obvious that he was just going to be taken around there. It was similar to the classic Causeway Derby trip, right? This is the, I'm not going to ruin this horse. I know he has no chance. I'll just cuddle him the whole way. And
somebody gave me a hard time for something I wrote about that. I said it was pretty snarky. You'd like it.
I love
something to the effect of it was like sort of doing a trip nut kind of thing. And I said, Classic Causeway appeared to be a social runner. You know, they made no effort to, you know, run at any point during the race that I could discern. But those winner's circle suites were really nice, and I bet the owners had an awesome day out.
That's exactly what I would have said. I mean, it was, they earned one of the 20. So, you know, he did his part. And I mean, I think I joked with somebody and said, I'm sure the instructions from Brian Lynch to Leperu were something along the lines of, don't ruin this horse for the rest of the year. You know, give us an opportunity to cut back and win big races.
Simplifications ride. I wasn't planning on mentioning it, but, you know, I thought this was a case of the right idea to try to win a race that just didn't really work out, you know, to use him a little bit more and try to get him involved. I feel like his, and maybe I'm just being a little master of the obvious about this because of Gunavara, but I feel like his future will be, you know, an underneath tri-key. Let's say the Travers. Let's say everybody who could go to the Travers goes to the Travers. Let's just fantasize for a minute. And you end up with Epicenter and Early Voting and Rich Strike even in there and all these horses that take money. And Gunavara will be my bottom-up tri-key in there to come running from off the pace and get a little slice at 20-1. That's what I'm seeing for the simplification. I think I said Gunavara. Simplification, Gunavara style will be my bottom-up tri-key in a spot like that.
Yeah, they say he bled also, so that probably makes sense on why he kind of went backwards in the stretch. But yeah, I agree. He's going to be given some time off. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't end up seeing him until somewhere around Gulfstream of next year.
Oh, really?
It was bad. Yeah. So that makes sense because this was the first time in his whole career he didn't run. Right. You know, I think one of the things, and we touched on this a little bit with regards to his chances in the Belmont, one of the more positive things about Creative Minister's effort is that he was pretty forwardly placed. And I think that makes him obviously a lot more dangerous in the Belmont. He kind of got away from Secret Oath late for third too. So he really finished. And it's obviously a lot easier to take a horse that's going to be, you know, 3 or 4 lengths off the pace theoretically in the Belmont than one that's going to be 10 or 12.
We will talk a little bit about the Belmont, and then I do want to get at least a comment from you about the issue of the day with this Triple Crown extension stuff that we've already done poll shows about, but we haven't really talked about it in a couple of weeks, you and I. But in terms of the Belmont field itself and the way this is shaking out, Rich Strike, is he going to be the favorite in there at this point?
I mean, it feels like if not him, then Mo Donegal probably. I think there'll be a lot of Mo Donegal love between Todd Pletcher and the distance, and you know that type of thought. And he's going to come in with a 5th place finish in the Derby. Yeah, so it's hard for a horse who went off 80-1 to go off the favorite in the next race if it has a reasonably sized field. There's going to be a lot of love for We the People, who comes in with a flashy win in the Peter Pan. But I would say based on the 10 prospects that we're seeing right now, which there should be like 8 more, I would say that I'd probably make Mo Donegal a soft favorite and Rich Strike one of the choices. But you know, you never know, Pete. Look at the reaction that we saw on Saturday. Maybe everybody is going to wish that they bet on him in the Derby and they're going to bet on him in the Belmont, and that might drive his odds down a whole click. So
coverage is certainly going to center around him. That, you know,
oh,
you
yeah
know that. I mean, he's the whole marketing campaign, isn't he?
Yeah.
It is, of course, as a racing fan, you know, I had that one moment, you know, right past the wire. Man, what a race it'll be if we get to see Early Voting and Epicenter come back in the Belmont against Rich Strike. What an easy way to market and tell, you know, and then, of course, you realize very quickly that none of it's going to happen. Now, Early Voting, no surprise, of course, that they were concerned about the mile and a quarter for wasn't going to probably be running in this Belmont under any circumstance. I do think, and it's interesting because it gets back into what we were talking before about Epicenter and this idea of him maybe being a little bit off form. I mean, I have to say, I think it is, I still am remaining agnostic in this, but I do think the way that this Triple Crown has played out, and less so about Rich Strike not coming back at the Preakness, and almost more so about Epicenter not wanting to go on to the Belmont, I think it's a relevant data point in the Randy Moss favor of the argument. Now, I know you espouse the idea of tradition when we talked about this a couple weeks ago. You talked about the idea of, you know, these high level connections in many cases, even owing it to the game to try to compete in these biggest races on the biggest days. I don't know if you got to hear Randy's thoughts on this. I was just curious if your thinking has been affected at all, if you're still full on three races in 5 weeks and that's the way it's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my preference for sure. I think there are two different arguments going on, and I think people are misinterpreting Randy's a little bit. Randy is not trying to make the Triple Crown easier. He's trying to increase the participation of horses in all three legs. And it's pretty tough to argue with what he's saying in the sense that few Derby horses are participating in the Preakness, and even fewer horses are running in all three. In fact, in this particular year, it's zero. And I believe last year it was zero. There might have been one. I can't remember.
It's typically been one or zero, I feel.
Yeah, it's generally been right. It's generally been close to zero. And that's not to say that there have been years where horses have run in all three and gone on to have perfectly fine campaigns. Will Take Charge ran in all three and lost the Breeders' Cup Classic by a head. So, you know, it's something that can be done. He also won the Travers. So there's that part of it. I don't think we need to make the Triple Crown easier. In fact, I think elongating the series is going to make it exponentially harder.
Yeah,
you're going to invite in a ton of new fresh horses. You're going to ask a horse to now hold their good form for 10 weeks as opposed to five, and that's going to make it significantly harder. So, I think there's also a little bit of recency bias when you're looking at the Pimlico card and the Preakness field, and you feel like, oh God, I mean, look at what this has become. And it's also important to remember that those were a bunch of $100,000 stakes races. So, I mean, they weren't exactly going to lure the type of fields that Belmont Day or Derby Day do. You know, with due respect to the folks at the Strana Group that are trying to do everything they can to put together a good card, you know, you're not going to get the field for $100,000 in the Jim McKay Turf Sprint that you are in the Jiper, you know? And so that part is understandable. Is there a concern about not the viability of the Preakness, but the health of the Preakness based on where we're going right now? Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, let's be honest, when Brad Cox comes out on Monday after the Derby and basically says, you know, Cyberknife's not going to run again until late June or mid June. That's ridiculous. Right. You know, I mean, that's, and Zandon's not running again until the Jim Dandy. I mean, he's run three times as a three-year-old. So,
you know, racing.
You're right. And the problem that we're running into is that as we cater to that more and more, our racing calendar is just going to get obliterated. There's just going to be nothing left. And, you know, I think I was joking with you last week and I said Travers becomes the new Super Saturday. And, you know, fall racing is totally and completely irrelevant, which, by the way, there's a lot of folks in Kentucky that want to make sure that Keeneland stays sacred. Yeah. So, you know, Keeneland will always exist at a high level, but I don't want to get tangential with the whole thing, but it's a really, really nasty, slippery slope to start to go down the path of, well, let's build more time into this because, you know, horses are just not capable of it. No, horsemen are not capable of running their horses that frequently. That's the problem. It's not in their comfort zone.
Stephen Chris made a great point about using financial incentives to try to build up the series as it is, as opposed to bending to the will of horsemen that may or not be, you know, accurate in terms of what they think their horses need, as opposed to what the horses are actually capable of. I thought that was an interesting idea. I will say this: if it's gonna change, I know this. Now you're gonna want the happy pills that you think I'm on when I say this, but it really needs to be looked at holistically from key industry players, not just, in my opinion, not just First Racing and Naira, but let's really look at what this is going to do the summer schedule. I mean, some of the things you see on social media make me just laugh. You know, oh well, it'll you know, what'll happen to the early Saratoga Stakes schedule? It's like, I'm sorry, the Jim Dandy had six horses in it last year. If that's a casualty of moving the Belmont back a few weeks, like, that's not the reason not to do it. But rather than just make a decision or not make a decision, it'd be wonderful to see key players sit down and look at what this new schedule, if it were to even be, I'm not saying it has to be, but let's like really look at it and see how it would be for all parties. One thing I can guarantee you is bad for racing, and I know you got to get out of here, Nick, so I won't keep you too much longer, but one thing I can guarantee would be bad for racing is just first, you know, and there are partners, but I'd say this to anybody at first, so I'll just say it on air, to act unilaterally and just move the race and say, well, mile and a half versus mile and 3/16, horsemen are going to choose us, let's give the one up four down to Naira. That's not going to redound to the sport's benefit. And knowing racing, I wouldn't put it as impossible, but I'd surely like to think that all cooler heads would prevail and some decision could be made, like, for the collective good of these entities. And I do think there's some way, if working together, it could be to the benefit of not just the Preakness itself, but that whole undercard. How much do you think I'm dreaming in the idea that we might actually see some coordination between our pals at first and Naira and other industry players in this regard?
I wish that everybody in the industry liked getting together and talking about things as much as horse players do. But I think we're the group that likes to join up and talk more than anybody else. So I'm a little concerned about that happening. I've heard some discussion of, you know, them doing it on their own and saying, look, this is our new date, adjust. And I think that would obviously be bad from a, the problem also there is that they've got a TV deal to work out. So, I mean, they've got to see where things shake out with the television contracts. Obviously, that's getting splintered as of 2023 because the Belmont's going to Fox. And so, you know, a lot of different things go on there. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of races stand to really get hurt by a later Belmont. The Haskell's the one that comes to mind most. And you want to maintain the integrity of that race, I think, as much as possible. It's a very hard conversation. I mean, if you start moving those dates around to the second and third legs, it gets very, very tricky. And I don't think people are exactly lining up to go to the Belmont on July 4th. So it's just a different time of year. You know, school's not even out when the Belmont happens in the Northeast, and it is the thick of summer by July 1st. So, yeah, it's a complex question, and I really hope it's one that we don't have to answer anytime soon, because I don't think there's a good answer.
You make some very good points about how the schedule would work, and I would just love to see more data on it. I will say one thing about the keep it the way it is argument. Too many people are just knee-jerking it without, like, I mean, it's a serious enough concern that it deserves to be discussed and data looked at and considered. And then, look, if it is too risky for valid reasons like you just brought up, and I mean, I think it's quite likely that the right decision will be to keep it the way it is. But just to say, no, this is the way it is and deal with it is not productive at this point.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, we're going to let you go, Nick, and we'll have you back late week, and we'll do a bunch of handicapping. But always great getting a chance to catch up with you, and let's do it again soon.
Always. Sounds good, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Today's show also brought to you by BetMakers. For the first time in over a century, fixed odds betting powered by BetMakers is available on track at Monmouth, soon going to be available throughout the state. And from there, who knows? Hopefully the country. Hopefully it'll spread like wildfire, like PASPA. Because let me tell you, the feedback I'm getting from horse players who've been there at Monmouth playing on these fixed odds markets, it's been very positive. A chance to get real value in your hands, because the odds you bet are the odds you get. Going to be hearing a lot more about fixed odds betting opportunities, especially vis-a-vis June 4th, BetMakers Day at Monmouth. Also, not coincidentally, I'm going to guess, the Pick Your Prize contest too. So you can go there, learn about fixed odds, bet fixed odds, play in the contest, have a great old day. Circle it on your calendar, June 4th at Monmouth. I'll probably be there the 3rd. I'll probably be there the 5th as well. I'm not committing to that last one yet. We'll see how everything goes. But I'm definitely going to be there for June 4th. You should be too. Thank you to our sponsors, the BetMakers. Next up on the show, we welcome back to the In the Money Airwaves the sounds of animals barking, dogs specifically. We love that. Mugsy the Handicapping Labrador. She just has been upstairs. You know, she lost her enthusiasm for our whole act when we left DRF years ago. Still can't quite figure that one out. She's still in effect. She's upstairs rattling her chain, walking around. But the steps and the 16-year-old dog don't quite go too well together. Anyway, that's just a little preamble as I get excited to introduce my friend coming to us from Saratoga Springs, though not where I usually see him, up in Saratoga Springs, which is at the Brentwood Hotel. He is at an undisclosed location, apparently in the woods. We're going to bring him in right now. Marcus Severin. Marcus, how are things?
Pete, things are so good. How are you doing today, man?
Life is good. Life is good. I is that your dog barking or a neighbor? What's going on?
No, that's a neighbor dog that I was really hoping. They came out just as we got rolling here. It was really nice and peaceful and serene here. And then we hit go and it was just bark. So that's fine.
I do love it. It gives me a I hadn't name checked Muggsy the Handicapping Labrador in way too long on these airwaves. So I'm glad we it's a feature, not a bug, if you like to say. I'll tell you what, the animal interruptions that I really enjoy in Saratoga are actually at the Brentwood, whether you're staying there or just getting a drink at the bar in the early morning, maybe on a Sunday, you get a chance to see the horses walk right by.
That's very true. That's my go-to Jeopardy fact for a lot of our guests at the hotel. I've never actually done the research to confirm this, but the words that I've been told was that Gridley Street, which is the street that the Brentwood sits on, is the only public street in North America that racehorses use to commute to work.
Fantastic.
I'm right
here in the USA.
I could very well be wrong, and I'm happy to hear if someone can disprove that to me, but I know that they cross the street from the paddocks to the course and all these other places, and Saratoga down Gridley Street, they share the street with the cars, and it's pretty interesting.
It's an amazing place, and it's cool for so many reasons. Now, I don't want to get people too psyched about staying at the Brentwood this summer because, from what I understand, your availability very limited at this point. At the same time, those who don't ask don't get. And if you're up there, especially during the week or looking to divide a stay between places or just put your name on the waiting list, Marcus is the man to talk to. But am I correct in that you're 80% full or so?
Yeah, I haven't had weekend availability for a few months now. Only having 12 rooms, we fill up quite quickly. And the word has definitely gotten out thanks to working with you and a number of things that we've done around town. People know and love the Brentwood now, and it is it's getting tight to get in there during race season. I do still have some midweek availability and early week. A travel plan that I really think would work great for a lot of people is coming up Tuesday night. It's still a dark day, but being that you can possibly get into a few more restaurants where it's going to be tougher to get into later in the week. You go out, get a nice meal on Tuesday night, get up early, go to the track first thing in the morning, spend the whole day at the track, crash at the Brentwood one more night, and then you head home Thursday morning. And that sounds like a pretty great little midweek getaway to me.
That sounds fantastic. And of course, a lot of people we know from our stats are in the New England, New York, New Jersey area, certainly a place you could consider going up for a beautiful fall weekend. How's your fall looking?
The fall at the Brentwood is great. I've got plenty of availability, although weekends are starting to get a little bit thick. We get the leaf peeping crowd. They come up, people wanting to get out of the city and see a little bit of nature in the fall. That changing of seasons is, I've been all over this country and I don't know any place like Saratoga where the trees just light up here when those seasons change. So the horses are still training up until early until the ground starts to get pretty hard. So we saw horses this year, I believe into November, about mid-November, they started to all head down to Florida or wherever else they might head. But much like much of the other Saratoga demographic, it gets a little cold and they get out of there.
Yes. Guilty as charged, my friend. Guilty as charged.
Yes, sir.
It is a great place to watch racing, even off season, because, as Marcus points out, plenty to do. And then with so many racing friendly places to go, you just treat it like your simulcast center. I've done that many, many times. Anyway, worth looking into. But you're here primarily. We led with that, but we're really here to talk about two other things. I will probably get accused of a host fail if I don't say this one first. We're going to be doing live shows from the Brentwood, which we've done in the past. We're going to be adding a wrinkle this year. We're going to do them live streaming on YouTube, which I think will be a lot of fun for people around the country. But it also means if you're in the area on a Sunday, let's just call it 11:30, come on by. I haven't started booking guests yet, but based on some of the names from the world of racing and handicapping that we've had over the course of the last few years, you won't be disappointed. Come check it out. we're going to learn about how the bar has changed, and we can figure out exactly what it is we're going to be drinking in a minute. But have a drink and get a chance to meet and say hi. I've made some great friends from some of the listeners and just people staying at the hotel who've come by to see our shows on the weekends. Going to be doing every Sunday at 11:30. Really looking forward to that. You have a vision. We're going to like dress a set and make it look pretty and everything.
Yeah, you know, the Brentwood is a very visual place. As great as the podcast sounds from there, I think that a live stream is just going to be incredible. For those who maybe came last year and weren't able to get in because the interior of the bar had been closed, this is going to provide a great opportunity for people to see what we're doing over there, because the Brentwood and our new bar, which we've renamed Farrier, is just such a gorgeous place. And I think it's going to make a really awesome setting for this podcast. And maybe we can set you up at the bar and I'll just be pouring you guys drinks while you talk, or we'll come up with something fun.
We can have that work out. That plan doesn't sound like a bad one at all. And I know you've got mad courting skills from what you've done with the audio setup up there. I love the idea of having people back in. It's gonna be great fun, and looking forward to working with you. Now, so the bar Farrier, have your neighbors from across the street? Is this with their blessing, or is it controversial?
I haven't gotten any pushback. You know, we were looking for a good name for the bar. We were throwing all these things out, and Farrier just played into our location. And, you know, with our design of the hotel, it's a word that in script looked nice, but I've made sure on all of our signage to make sure that the word bar is very predominant on there, so we don't get horses rolling in looking for some new shoes.
For those that don't know, the Horseshoe is the name of the bar across the street. Yeah. Very different vibe over there. Co-opetition all the way. Not any bad blood between the
no,
two.
No, not at all. Not at all. They're great. I mean, they kill it over there. Friday, Saturday night, you got your live music, and we sit on our patio and sip a nice glass of wine by the fire while they go hard across the street. And it's two different worlds that, you know, it's the yin and the yang of race season.
Saratoga nightlife, indeed.
Yeah.
So Farrier, this rebranded bar, you know, Brentwood, I would have said it was known for cocktails previously. Are cocktails still in the mix? What kind of a reinvention do we have going on here?
Yeah, you know, cocktails are definitely and will still on the menu and will continue to be. We're focusing more on classic cocktails, your Negronis, your Manhattans, and really dialing in the things that, you know, we can do with minimal extra work. Of previously, we had to make all these bitters from scratch and a lot of simple syrups, and those things are great, but there's plenty of other places in town that are doing that, and we wanted to kind of switch our focus onto some really interesting wines while maintaining that cocktail menu. And then we're expanding into a few food options, which we previously did not have, which are pretty exciting.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Events wise, I mean, I imagine you're so busy in the summer, maybe that's not the time for events, but I know that off racing season, you've done some fun event stuff at the Brentwood. Anything coming up in that regard to potentially tell us about?
Keep an eye out on our social media. We are working on our kind of Farrier launch party. We launched the bar in the middle of winter, and you know, I wanted to have the patio all in bloom and everything for when we really brought people in to show them what we're doing. So it's kind of been a soft open for us.
Cool.
But I definitely want to do some more things. Being the general manager of both the hotel and the bar, I've been spread a bit thin here the past couple months. So I'm staffing back up, and hopefully I can return to getting those events put together, because those are really what I enjoy to do.
You've done some really cool stuff in the past, and we'd love to figure out some way to collaborate on something. I still have this vision for doing a screening of Let It Ride somehow in that back lot or somewhere there, and we get some grills going and have a great old time. At some point, we have to make that become.
We got to do it. Got to do it.
And last question for you. I think I know the answer, but I'm relieved to hear it. When you mentioned the idea of going to more of a wine focus, I was wondering if you were going to go full-on wine bar. I just want to make sure on a Sunday morning while I'm doing the show, I can get my spicy Bloody Mary with a beer back. Because knowing how Saturday nights are in Saratoga, I think I'm going to need that Sunday if I'm going to be my best on air.
It's a Sunday morning staple at the Brentwood. Yeah, we're still playing around with our weekend hours, but definitely we'll be open for our handicapping happy hour. Bloodies and mimosas will be flowing as always, and maybe we'll come up with a couple new things to put on the menu too.
I like the sound of it. Yeah, there are some fun breakfast drinks, actually. We'll talk about that offline. We'll leave that production meeting for outside the show. Marcus, thank you so much for coming on. We encourage people to check out Brentwood and Ferrier. Tell them where they can find you, website and on social.
Yes, so www.brentwood-hotel.com for all things reservations. You can navigate as well through that to the Ferrier website. Social media, we are at ferrier.bar for the bar, obviously, and at Brentwood-hotel, I believe. I'm going to actually double check that here. I was, you caught me a little off guard. Brentwood, I'm sorry, the_Brentwood to follow the hotel, but then ferrier.bar for the bar.
Let's do it. All right. Good stuff, Marcus. We'll be talking soon.
All right. Thanks, Pete. Take care.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. We want to thank Marcus Severin from the Brentwood and, of course, Nick Tamaro for stopping by as well. Sponsors of this show, BetMakers and Santa Anita, will thank them, as well as our founding partners, 10 Strike Racing. Great fun with some of the 10 Strike crew this weekend at the Preakness. Big weekend for them in a lot of different ways. So congrats to our friends at 10 Strike and Marshall Graham in particular for owning a relative of the Preakness winner. Not too bad. Not too bad, is it? Okay, who else? Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. I meant to say this earlier. We've still got a few bottles of the new whiskey that Doug O'Neill and Mario Gutierrez have signed to commemorate the 10th anniversary of All Have Another. It's also got the great new Derby poster label on it, which I particularly attractive this year. You can get those. The company is out of Louisville. Louisville Stoneware, but the easiest way to get the link, trfinc.org/players. Get these while they last. Really, really cool bottle. Check it out. Who else? Well, thank producer Craig. We're making him work a little bit overtime. And how about Drew Coatney, the business manager here at In the Money Media, our creative officer. What do we call him? The chief creative officer. That's Jonathan Kitchen. We'll thank him as well. I'm Peter Thomas Fornitown. May you win all your photos.